I want to talk tonight about engaged Buddhism in a general sense, and then how I am understanding it right now for myself. So engaged Buddhism began as a practice in which we take our mindfulness and heart practices off of our cushions and out to the suffering in the world. And it's not any kind of social action. It's a social action in which we're aware of our motivation or our intention. So although all kinds of reactivity may be arising, our action isn't motivated by anger, and obviously not avoidance, but rather by compassion. And further, that engaged Buddhism includes not only bringing our practice out into the world, but never excluding ourselves, always including ourselves, always aware of the suffering within us and addressing that. So I want to share just some basics about the history of engaged Buddhism, a little bit of a really wonderful interview with Thich Nhat Hanh, and I also want to share a practice. So I have a lot I want to cover. So Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh is credited with coining the phrase engaged Buddhism, which may not be news to many of you. During the Vietnam War, he and his community of monastics had to decide what to do when the villages around them were being bombed. Should they continue to meditate in their monastery, or should they go out into the streets to help the people who'd been hurt? And they decided to do both, to help people and to do so in mindfulness. And it's interesting because Vietnam has a long monastic tradition. And when the French were colonizing Vietnam, the monastics in that point in history made a decision to stay in the monasteries, though there was a lot of suffering going on, because their understanding or belief was that self-liberation is for the benefit of all beings. And so staying focused on the internal contemplative work was the choice that was made then. And then in the late 1950s, Thich Nhat Hanh was a very young person, and they actually began the movement with just 3 young people, and then became 6 young people, all between the ages of the mid-20s to the very early 30s, that were the ones that had the kind of determination and willingness and courage to not only step out in the streets, which was already massively brave, but break with a certain kind of a belief system or tradition and move out into the world. So in addition to Thich Nhat Hanh, as one of our sort of founders of engaged Buddhism, there's also Sulak Sivarasca, who's a Thai Buddhist activist and scholar who's done a lot of work around infrastructure of socially engaged Buddhism. And then also, some interestingly, B.R. Ambedkar, who you may know because he was also in the 1950s and 60s, a very major force of revolution and change for the untouchables in India, the Dalit class. And he had grown up, you know, being an untouchable, but brilliant. He had studied and learned in school by being one of those people, which also happened with racism here in the United States, one of those people who had to sit outside the classroom because he wasn't considered pure enough to be allowed in the class with the other students. And then went to England to get his master's and PhD, and he became a jurist, a politician, and he ultimately converted to Buddhism and began this huge movement to support and help and change the Dalit folks, and many, many others ended up converting to Buddhism as well. And it's an ongoing, like all of these things, change takes time, and it's an ongoing movement. Again, not unlike some of the oppressions that we experience here in the United States, including racism. Ambedkar was very inspired by Thich Nhat Hanh's work and took on this notion of Buddhism being both inner and outer. The Buddha said in the Dhammapada, hatred will never cease by hatred. By love alone will it end. And it was that as a kind of a rallying call for the various engaged Buddhists around the world, including, as time went on, here in the United States, who wanted to kind of ground in presence and love, and then allow our action to come from that. The Buddha said, I teach only two things, suffering and the end of suffering. And he didn't qualify whether he was talking about the suffering within us, the suffering outside ourselves. But the big insight, one of the big learnings that we get on our journey in Vipassana Buddhism, are what are called the three characteristics of existence: impermanence, imperfection, or dukkha or suffering, and no separate self. We are a part of the fabric, and within us is also many strands or many energies, and they can be polarized from in each other right inside ourselves. And it's that way outside ourselves too. And the motive or the imperative for Buddhism is to encounter suffering and know that the best way to deal with it is through determination and compassion, presence and curiosity, and open-minded courage. And that's both within and without. And ultimately, with the insight into selflessness, there is no within and without. But the rallying call remains. Whether we, even with that big insight into we are all one, as consciousness encounters suffering, the instruction is hold it in presence and compassion. Now, compassion is a word that needs to be unpacked a little bit. It isn't only like deep friendliness, although it is that. It can be very strong boundaries. It can be courage. It can be motivation. It can be a strong no, but coming from love. You may have heard the story of when Sharon Salzberg, Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg, was a young practitioner in India on her way to see Maharishi, one of her teachers. She was in a little rickshaw and it was raining, and a crowded place in Calcutta that they were going through. And a big, strong person came just up through the crowd and pulled her out of the rickshaw. And it was really terrifying. She thought she was on her way out. But she wriggled away. She got away. She got back in the rickshaw. She made it to her teacher, and her teacher was talking about unconditional loving kindness. So in her interview, she said to her teacher, told the teacher this event and said, how do I practice unconditional loving kindness when somebody is pulling me out of my rickshaw, trying to kill me? And the teacher said, with all the loving kindness possible in your heart, you hit him over the head as hard as you can with your umbrella. So compassion, and isn't that story isn't unlike another story that the Dalai Lama was here in Berkeley at the Greek Theater some years ago. And somebody during the Q&A section, somebody asked him, you know, he had been talking the whole time about compassion, compassion, compassion. And somebody said, you're talking about compassion, but what do we do with people who abuse children? And these really, you know, there were some very explicit examples of really criminal behavior with children. And the Dalai Lama said, absolutely, the most compassionate thing you can do for the children and for the perpetrator is to lock them away. Lock them away, he said. Because, of course, not only does that protect the children, but it protects the perpetrator from the karma of their own actions. So when we talk about compassion, we need to remember that we're not talking about only a tender kind of deep, loving addressing of non-threatening suffering. We're talking about addressing even the most difficult, vile types of suffering that we see. And also the most difficult kinds of suffering we have inside ourselves, the parts of ourselves that are addicted to things, the parts of ourselves that act out, the inner critic part, you know, the all this stuff that we're like, we wish weren't there inside ourselves, but is there. Learning to turn toward that with presence and spaciousness and care and curiosity and inquiry. So I'll say more about this in a moment, but that's the teaching here, that we're both within and without. Thich Nhat Hanh speaks of interdependence as central to a Buddhist view of the universe, the interbeing, as he puts it, of people, nations, and the whole ecological fabric of the natural world. Our most important task, he says, is to develop correct insight. If we see deeply into the nature of interbeing, that all things inter are, and maybe your practice has allowed you to see this, and even those, there are times when we're contracted into a small self, even then, it's just logical. All things inter are. Of course they are. Of course they are. You have your ancestors and your parents and the things you eat and nature and miracle made your body and sustain your body. And the earth is holding you and supporting you. And the air is breathing you even as we speak right now. And he says, if we see deeply into the nature of interbeing, that all things inter are, we'll stop blaming, arguing, and killing. And we'll become friends with everyone to practice nonviolence. He says, and this is where I want to get to practice nonviolence, we must first of all learn ways to deal peacefully with ourselves. So to the degree that, you know, and this is just human, but to the degree that we're still at war with ourselves, we won't be able to bring peace into the world. He says, not just making peace, but being peace is the key to engaged Buddhism. So now I want to share this a little bit of this interview. And if this interview catches your interest, you can easily just Google Thich Nhat Hanh and journalist John Malkin, John M-A-L-K-I-N. This is an interview that happened in 2002. Thich Nhat Hanh says, engaged Buddhism is just Buddhism. When bombs begin to fall on people, you cannot stay in the meditation hall all the time. Meditation is about the awareness of what is going on, not only in your body and in your feelings, but all around you. When I was a novice in Vietnam, we young monks witnessed the suffering caused by the war, so we were very eager to practice Buddhism in such a way that we could bring it into society. That was not easy, because the tradition did not directly offer engaged Buddhism, so we had to do it by ourselves. That was the birth of engaged Buddhism. It's interesting because in that paragraph, he begins by saying, engaged Buddhism is just Buddhism. It's just Buddhism. Suffering and the end of suffering. Addressing suffering. Acknowledging interbeing. Inner is outer, outer is inner. And yet then he goes on to finish that paragraph by saying, well, and we had to invent engaged Buddhism because the tradition at that time in that culture didn't have the going out in and being of service out in the world. And just as an aside, when the monastics were going out into Vietnam and they were doing they did a fantastic job, and it started with three people, but ended up being more than 10,000 people coming out of the monasteries to help. When they did that, they were nonpartisan. They were serving both sides. And they saw how the people of Vietnam were being crushed by leaders on both sides who wanted goodies from two different superpowers. But people were suffering. And so the monastics were going out and dealing with everybody on all sides of the conflict. And so they were punished by both sides. And so the monastics themselves had a lot of suffering and a lot of courage and a lot of acting from compassion. What happened was in 1966, Thich Nhat Hanh was invited to come to the United States to give a series of talks in universities on the East Coast. And while he was here, he was exiled from Vietnam, and he wasn't able to go back for many decades after that. So he found himself, without expecting to be, he found himself in the United States in 1966, became friends with Dr. Martin Luther King, and was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Dr. King. And also he was teaching people here about the effects of the Vietnam War. And so this is a little farther down in the interview. He speaks about that being here. He says, people were very compassionate and willing to support us in ending the war in Vietnam during the 60s. But the peace movement in America did not have enough patience. People became angry very quickly because what they were doing wasn't bringing about what they wanted. So there was a lot of anger and violence in the peace movement. And I find that very poignant because I think that's part of our culture. We are the mainstream culture here in the United States. We kind of have learned to be like, I want what I want when I want it now, including in our movements, our social change movements. And it's hard to see the long term. Like in Bhutan, where they have the 500-year plan, that's not something Americans would typically do. So he noticed that here in the 60s, that we were reactive here in the United States. He goes on, nonviolence and compassion are the foundations of a peace movement. If you don't have enough peace and understanding and loving kindness within yourself, your actions will not truly be for peace. Everyone knows that peace has to begin with oneself, but not many people know how to do it. I remember, just an aside for a moment, I remember in the 90s, I got a job as a children's choir director at the Oakland Unitarian Church. And one song we sang every week with the kids was, let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me. You may remember that song. And we at least pay lip service to that understanding. But if we don't have, you know, concrete ways of working with our own reactivity, calming our own fires, which doesn't mean not ever being angry, by the way. Our anger, our rage, our hate, they arise naturally and they are letting us know that something's wrong. And what we can do is turn toward the anger and the hate with, again, curiosity and compassion, sustain the discernment that's there in the anger, acknowledge something's wrong, something's not okay, sustain the discernment, but work with the reactivity and calm it down. Touch into our deepest intentions, our deep hearts, that bodhicitta, that wisdom of heart mind that we have access to with mindfulness. And then fuel the discernment with compassion. Why do we care? Because we love, because we value, because we sense into the sensitive interbeing of all things, and we care. And then taking our action from that place. The interviewer, John Malkin, says, people often feel that they need to choose between being engaged in social change or working on personal and spiritual growth. What would you say to those people? Thich Nhat Hanh, I think that view is rather dualistic. The practice should address suffering, the suffering within yourself and the suffering around you. They're linked to each other. When you go to the mountain and practice alone, i.e. go on retreat, you don't have the chance to recognize the anger, jealousy, and despair that's in you. So it's good that you encounter people. It's good to know those emotions so that you can learn to recognize them, acknowledge them, respond to them with compassion, and look into their nature. If you don't know the roots of greed, hatred, and delusion, you can't see the path leading to their cessation. If you don't have enough peace and understanding and loving kindness within yourself, your actions will not truly be for peace. So it's so cool because all this work that we do, all this labor that we do on our own hearts and minds, where we're where we're actually, you know, using wise effort to transmute unmitigated reactivity to patience and truthfulness and generosity and loving kindness and compassion. The object is this apparent self, but to any degree, we're doing that actual work with practice and community. We're actually doing that work where we're working with pushing our edges around our conditioning, around stinginess and you know, jealousy and anger and all those kind of reactive emotions. We're working with them. And we actually make some progress. To whatever degree we've done that with our own hearts, that skill set is available for dealing with others. Have you noticed that? You know, like if you are more patient with yourself and your own little kooky quirks, you are immediately more patient with other people and their little quirks. And if I am more present with the truth of my own imperfection, the second of the three characteristics, the first noble truth, dukkha's here, within and without. I have more acceptance, more spaciousness of my own, you know, challenges and disappointments and downfalls. That immediately translates out with other people. The object isn't really the issue. The issue is the capacity, the skill building. Well, two things, the skill building and then the accessing of this deeper place, which we access every time we come into the now. So here in the now, this present moment, we have this capacity for consciousness. These words coming out of my mouth right now are coming out of my thinking mind, you know, and the thinking mind's super helpful, super necessary, not great when it's in charge. We have access to this other deeper knowing that isn't about practice. The practice is about accessing it, not about adding anything new. This wise, loving awareness that we tap into with practice that can more and more guide our actions. It's like that Ojibwe saying, sometimes I go about in distress when all the while I'm being carried across the sky by the wind. That's a paraphrase and not nearly as beautiful as the original saying, but you get the idea. There's something there that we access with practice. So our practice is always simultaneously doing two things. It's untangling the tangle of conditioned thinking, and it's also giving us more access to a whole other way of knowing and moving that's much more heart-centered. And we can offer it to what's apparently self, and we can also offer it out into the world. So remember this, let me just check my time. This interview was in 2002, and in 2001 were the attacks on the World Trade Center. John Malkin, the interviewer, when the World Trade Center was destroyed, you were asked what you would say to those responsible. You answered that you would listen compassionately and deeply to understand their suffering. Well, first of all, wow. You know, like even a difficult neighbor is hard to listen compassionately and deeply to understand their suffering, let alone a perpetrator of extreme world violence. You know, like, wow, that was his response. So I'll just read that again and then I'll go on. Interviewer, when the World Trade Center was destroyed, you were asked what you would say to those responsible. You answered that you would listen compassionately and deeply to understand their suffering. Tell me about the practice of deep listening and how you think it helps in personal situations, as well as in situations like the World Trade Center attacks. Thich Nhat Hanh, the practice of deep listening should be directed toward oneself first. If you don't know how to listen to your own suffering, it will be difficult to listen to the suffering of another person or another group of people. I recommend that the American people listen to themselves first, because there is a lot of suffering within your borders. So there's a great deal more to that interview. Again, that's Thich Nhat Hanh and John Malkin, M as in man, A-L-K-I-N, 2002. It's fully reprinted in the 2003 edition of Lion's Roar, which had a different name at the time, but you'll find it online if you want to find it. I want to close with a practice. And this practice comes from Mindful Self-Compassion, Kristen Neff and Christopher Germer. But to me, it is a fabulous deep listening practice. And self-compassion means this is a deep listening to our own suffering. And these principles apply when we're working, practicing with, journeying toward this capacity of deep listening to the suffering of others, whether it's the suffering of a victim or the suffering of a perpetrator or anything in between. Hard to do, but done by people. So this practice, it's called a self-compassion break. And it has three components to it, which are mindfulness, interbeing, and kindness. Mindfulness is what mindfulness does, acknowledges what's arising in the present moment without adding any story to it. So mindfulness is part of the middle way, where we're not in denial. We're not pushing anything down or minimizing it or pretending it's not there, which is something we do a lot with suffering. We're not doing that. We're acknowledging that it's here. But on the other side, we're not doing the papancha thing, the rumination thing, where we're like, oh no, worst case scenario. And remember when that happened last time and I'm triggered and what if and yikes, 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 and all the stuff the mind can do. We're not doing that either. Mindfulness is just in the present moment, naming what is. So when suffering is arising in you, which of course it does, because it does for all living beings, when it's arising, mindfulness can acknowledge and just hold simply what's true. The pain, the loss, the confusion, the fear, the anxiety, the contraction, the depression, whatever it is. It can be with it and just that and not add more. So that's mindfulness. And then interbeing in this practice is just reminding the mind that you're not alone. And that's really important for our human minds because we have these mammalian brains that survived in herds. And if we think that, you know, we're alone or we have to be self-reliant with our trouble, which we do because of our belief in a separate self, it really scares the animal brain part that feels like it will not survive. So it really exacerbates the fight, flight, and freeze when we think we're somehow chronically unique with either our pain or our reactivity to the pain. So just reminding the mind that you're not alone. And then, so there's mindfulness, interbeing. And then the third one is kindness, where we deliberately bring in kindness because of the dukkha, because of the suffering. And this is a form of deep listening. So it's a short practice, and I'm just going to walk you through it right now. You can actually do this practice as I lead you through, or you can just listen and see what you think of it if you haven't tried it before. Again, it's called a self-compassion break, another thing you can easily find on the internet if this appeals to you. So for this practice, just take a moment as though you were going to do like a 2 or 3 minute mindfulness practice, and you can close your eyes if you like, but you don't have to. And deliberately think of a situation in your life that's difficult or that's causing you stress. Call the situation to mind and see if you can actually feel the stress and emotional discomfort in your body. And now say to yourself, this is a moment of suffering. And that's mindfulness. It's a using language to just name what's arising in the present moment. This is a moment of suffering. Other options could be, this hurts. Ouch. This is stress. And we talk, you know, easily we talk about stress. Here we're in a moment with stress and we're naming it. We're giving it its accurate nomer. This is stress. So that's the mindfulness piece of this short practice. And then we move to interbeing or common humanity. The second phrase is, suffering is a part of life. Suffering is a part of life. It's common humanity. Other options include, other people feel this way. I'm not alone. We all struggle in our lives. And then finally, I invite you to join me in putting your hands over your heart if you feel comfortable enough with that. And feel the warmth of your hands, the gentle touch of your hands. This is nonverbal metta, somatic metta. So you did the mindfulness, this is a moment of suffering. Common humanity, suffering is a part of life. And then the kindness. May I be kind to myself. Bringing in kindness, you know, there's so many other strategies we use for dealing with suffering, avoidance, blame, self-blame, etc. This is bringing in the kindness as a wise response to suffering. May I be kind to myself. And you might also ask yourself, what do I need to hear right now to express kindness to myself? And there may be certain language that is helpful right now to your system. Some possibilities could be, may I give myself the compassion that I need? May I learn to accept myself as I am? May I forgive myself? May I be strong? May I be patient? Okay. So thanks so much, everyone, for your kind attention. We just have a couple minutes left, but if anybody wants to share how that landed for you, the talk or the practice, please feel very warmly invited to share.
I have got to thank you. I was just listening to Krista Neff with this teaching a few days ago. I can't remember what summit it was on. And just before Sangha, I was listening to Sharon Salzberg talking about how she developed her loving kindness practice and became such a world-renowned teacher of loving. So the synchronicity of this week for me has been marvelous, unbelievable. And hearing you speak on these topics, all its pieces. I'm just grinning from ear to ear and very grateful. And I love the practice. And actually, there are some things going on right now where I really need to practice that practice a lot. So thank you for being here and thank you for this talk.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you so much for those kind words, Deborah. Really great for me to hear. I really appreciate it. And yeah, I think, you know, these times really call for a lot of practice, a lot of love flowing inward so that we can be grounded and calm, and then a lot of love flowing outward as well. Yeah, thank you. Sherry and Bowman.
Hi, Eve. What a treat to spend this time with you. I did a retreat with you some years ago with Donald Rothberg, the judgmental mind, and this little compassion break thing is wonderful. I've done a lot with Tara Brach with the rain practice.
Yeah, rain's great too. Yeah.
It's better.
Yeah.
Better. This is like the next, this is the piece that's missing.
Uh-huh.
For me anyway, in that. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. You're so welcome.
Really great to spend this time with you.
Yeah, thank great. You. Thank you, Eve.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me here. Yeah.